Last night, the Orchestre National de Lyon delighted music lovers at Carnegie Hall with performances of works by Cournonsson, Ravel, and Rimsky-Korsakov. The ONL, which is led by its world-renowned music director, Leonard Slatkin, is on a six-city tour of the United States, offering American audiences a program of largely French repertoire. In addition to directing that orchestra, Maestro Slatkin is music director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra and maintains a rigorous schedule of guest conducting. He's also an active composer, author, and educator whose more than 100 recordings have earned him 7 Grammy Awards along with 64 nominations. It is with great pleasure that I welcome Leonard Slatkin back to our show.
Very nice to see you again.
Although The Guardian has called it probably the most refined ensemble of the world, the Orchestre National de Lyon hasn't played in the United States since 2003. Why has it taken nearly 14 years to arrange a return?
Like so many European orchestras, our budget is determined not by private donations or fundraising, but rather by the budget of the city. A lot of tours that we take can occur in Europe, where transportation and costs of cargo are not so expensive. But to go through overseas tours, especially in the United States, where you have to pay fairly large fees to rent out a hall or a space, requires a much larger budget than we usually have. We were supposed to come 3 years ago, and we just decided we don't have the money, or the city decided for us. But this time they felt it was really worth the investment to come, and so far that has actually paid off great dividends.
And you've pretty much been limited to being on the East Coast, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, North Carolina, Georgia.
And Florida. Well, it's not so bad in February, Florida. Yeah. Well, it's not so bad here today.
last night's concert was a success. It opened with the U.S. premiere of a reconstructed version of Ravel's incidental music to Antar, symphonic suite by Rimsky-Korsakov. Why did Ravel write incidental music for another composer's composition?
He didn't really write that much of the music. What happened was that in 1910, exoticism was all the rage in Europe. Everybody wanted things from far away places. We already knew about Rimsky's Scheherazade, and Rimsky's second symphony, sometimes called the symphonic poem Antar, was another Middle Eastern-based subject, about a 25-minute symphony, that had fallen into neglect.
It's an Arabian tale.
That's right. So Ravel was working on Daphnis and Chloe in 1910, and he was asked to write incidental music for a play based on the subject of Antar. He didn't have time, but he said he would somehow figure out a way to incorporate music of Rimsky that he already knew and concoct it. He used not only the Antar Symphony of Rimsky, but an excerpt from his opera Mlada, a couple of songs, and then some little incidental bits of original music. So this is all meant to accompany a play that took about 5 hours.
And the program says that the work is reconstructed.
Well, we call it that because what we did was, when we found the music, it was really... many Ravel biographers and scholars didn't even know about this. So we had our crack research team go to the Bibliothèque in Paris, where we found the score and the parts for this incidental music for the play. In fact, the first performance of the play featured, among other things, as one of the exotic dancers, Mata Hari.
Hmm.
So it was quite popular for a little while, and then it completely disappeared. When I saw the score, and especially the portions that were in Ravel's hand, I thought there must be a way to do this. And so we commissioned Amin Malouf, a very distinguished Arab-French playwright and librettist. He's written the 4 librettos for Kaya Sarriaho's operas, to write a text to kind of connect the scenes together and tell the story. So we could play all of the music, put it in some sort of context with the story. And so this became, one, a French premiere, and then last night, an American premiere.
Narrated by the wonderful baritone Thomas Hampson.
And in an English translation.
And the three of you, I understand, collaborated on it.
Yeah, that's the great thing about online now. You can get in touch with anybody and fix things as you go along.
Well, how different is this than the original Rimsky-Korsakov?
Well,
is it more French?
No, part of it is. The part Ravel wrote there's one little waltz section that he wrote. It's clearly French. It doesn't even sound Ravelian, but you know it's French when you hear it. The rest of it is the Rimsky, and very much in and taken from the original Antar and other Rimsky works. So it sounds like Rimsky, but again, since Ravel himself was so influenced as an orchestrator by Rimsky, you hear parallels and connections between these two composers. It takes about 50 minutes or so to do. And we found not only in Lyon, but last night in New York, the reception of the audience was extraordinary. They loved it. They went, why don't we know this music? People don't even remember the Antar Symphony originally by Rimsky. It's not played anymore. But it's such glorious music. And this is one of those cases of bringing back an obscure work that doesn't observe the obscurity. Many do.
You were performing a number of Ravel pieces last night. You did Scheherazade with the great soprano.
One of the two Scheherazades of Ravel. There's an early overture that he wrote. So he was influenced by that subject matter.
And you finished with a performance of Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe.
Yeah.
And then in between, you featured the U.S. premiere of Selafias by Guillaume Cornesson.
Yes.
Which is based on a story by the American fantasy writer H.P. Lovecraft. So was all of last night's concert really about storytelling?
Yes. There was a real method in the madness. When you're coming with an orchestra from another place other than in the States, it's always been my feeling that I want to come in with something that represents how my orchestra is different. I did that all the time when I came with my orchestras from either St. Louis, Washington, Detroit.
Well, Detroit, you could just play a lot of Motown.
We could, but we also could play other things. We're not too bad at all this stuff.
So each orchestra had a very different sound?
We had a different sound and a different personality.
But isn't the conductor the person who determines the sound and personality?
The conductor is one of the aspects. The other one is the hall that it plays in. It's as if you want to adjust to the new facility that you're playing in, either here in New York or on tour. But ultimately what you want to do is to play as you sound in your home. So you use whatever rehearsal time you have, and even sometimes when you have no rehearsal, use the first piece to just get used to the acoustic of the room and find a way that you can bring your sound to the public.
For years, people complained about Carnegie Hall, but the sound has been adjusted. Is it fun to play in now?
Oh, for us, it was ideal. It's a perfect sound. So I'm old enough to remember not only listening to, but performing often in the older Carnegie Hall before they gutted the lower part of it. And I remember when it was refurbished, most of us railed against it because they'd taken out a lot of the wood and substituted metal and concrete instead. And we found the sound too bright, a little bit lacking in the bass low end. I think those things have definitely been improved. It's still not exactly the same.
The ceiling or something.
Yeah, it's still not exactly the same as it was in the old days where you had that rich, deep bass that just grabbed you in the gut. But still, for a French orchestra, which has a slightly lush but lighter sonority than other European and American orchestras, it was ideal for the way we play.
I'm speaking with Leonard Slatkin, who is currently on a 6-city tour.
Actually, it's 8 cities.
It's 8? Okay. Well, 6 cities to
maybe
go.
Maybe I can get a vacation that I didn't plan on. That'd be great.
The Orchestre National de Lyon. You, last weekend, in concerts in New Jersey and Connecticut, you performed Kina. A piece that you composed. Yeah. The Hebrew word for eulogy?
Elegy. Or lamentation. Mm. The world of composition is something I've done pretty much all my life, but I've kept it quiet. I don't really compose unless I feel like writing something. I never take a commission, and I don't charge anything for it. Well, this one occurred because a year ago December, my father would have turned 100, and I wanted to honor not just his memory, but my mother's as well. They were two of the great musicians from the West Coast during the great film years. My dad was the concertmaster at 20th Century Fox. My mother was the first cellist at Warner's, and her brother was the pianist at Warner's. So if you've seen any films from mid-30s to about 1953, 54, you've heard my parents. You couldn't miss them. They were also one half of the Hollywood String Quartet, and they were part of the popular music scene, particularly working closely with Frank Sinatra, who became a very good friend of our family.
He came to your father's funeral.
He Cayley did the eulogy there, and Uncle Frank, as my brother and I used to call him when we were little, would grab us by the hands and take us upstairs and sing us to sleep. Why didn't they have micro cassette recorders back then? It was just a great relationship with the Sinatra family. Anyway, so these two distinguished musicians, my parents, were getting ready to play something in public that they had never played in public before, and that was the logical Brahms double concerto for violin and cello. They rehearsed it on a Wednesday night with the orchestra. I was there. It was extraordinary. The concert was scheduled for Saturday, but my father died the Friday before, the night before. He was 47. I was 19. And I never felt I properly honored his memory. So I decided to write this piece and base it on the first four notes of the slow mode of the Brahms double. But it emerges into different melodic and harmonic elements. But only at the end do we hear finally that it is from the Brahms, but never with a phrase completed. It always stops to remind us that they never played it.
But you've written in your notes that at this time, when you were 19 years old, you weren't sure what you wanted to do with your life. I would have thought coming out of this family, music was a natural.
It was, as you say, we would have thought that. But then when my father died, and we weren't particularly close, not really, because they would be off in the studios in the day, and then there'd be time for dinner with the family for 1 hour, and then the other members of the quartet would show up and they would rehearse. So we didn't really have that kind of relationship. And after my father died, I was really not sure about what I wanted to do. I'd done all kinds of stuff, violin, viola, piano, composition, and I got out of it for a while. I thought I would be an English teacher. But gradually I worked my way back into music. And the other thing was my father was an outstanding conductor as well. He did a lot of things. And I was dogged, of course, as anybody who comes from a family like that, with the specter that I would be thought of as Felix's son. I wouldn't have my own persona. And gradually I accepted that. And then when things began to turn around and I had some degree of success, all of a sudden my mom, who was still alive, became Leonard's mom. And then when the recordings of the string quartet started garnering awards on their reissue, once again I was the son of Felix and Eleanor, but this time I loved it.
Now, you're leading a French orchestra.
Yeah.
Does everybody, do you have to speak French? How is your
French? My French is acceptable for a rehearsal. It's not so good in conversation, but at a rehearsal I can get all the ideas across. The majority of the orchestra speak enough English when I get in trouble, and there are people who can translate for me. But we have what I like to call répétition française, which is for the rehearsal. It's the same for me in any language. I can
Lyon is
learn the
famous
basics.
For its great restaurants. Very different than Paris, even though Paris is pretty great restaurants too.
Yes, but the difference is that if you look in the Michelin guide, which is always what everybody checks out, there's only one three-toque restaurant in all of Lyon, and that's the big Paul Bocuse. Mm. So the question is, if in the city which is regarded as the home of the culinary arts, why is only one restaurant rated in the highest category? And the reason for that is you can go into a small neighborhood in Lyon, duck into a bistro where the food is just outstanding. But is it a fancy restaurant? No. Are the waiters really concerned about that special kind of service? Does every plate have this or that on it? What's the decor? So in Lyon, it is only about the food.
I mentioned that you also are an author. You have a book, Conducting Business, Unveiling the Mystery Behind the Maestro, which describes what it's like to try to earn a living as a conductor. And you, I understand you're working on a second book.
Second one
Behind
comes
the
out.
Baton.
Well, we changed the title, and it comes out in October. It's called Leading Tones, and it'll be a bit more controversial than the first one.
And then on February 15th, you release the fifth installment of your conducting school, a video-based conducting lesson. This one deals with something I've always been curious about. You're teaching the novice conductor to put two hands together, the two hands working totally independently right. of each other. Mm-hmm. I've always wondered about that. I know drummers have a hard time learning how to develop that independence. But with your hands, it must be even... Well,
imagine that the old thing about rubbing your head and your stomach in opposite directions. It's the same thing. You have to get to the point where your brain doesn't think about it. You just do it. The idea of the videos, and they're on my website, is to tell people who are music lovers. They're not really for musicians so much. It's just to get the average person, much like the first book, understanding what it is we do and how we do it. The basics of conducting, the basic techniques, anybody can do. It's not that complicated at the basic technical level. But I wanted to take some time just to explain it. And we'll do this for... Every episode comes out on the 15th of next month. We've got eight more that we've completed. And then, when that's finished, I'm going to work with live musicians to actually show people within the repertoire how you technically accomplish certain things.
But I gather you're no longer going... This is your final season with the Detroit Symphony.
It's my last year in Lyon, and next year is the last one in Detroit.
And then what are you going to do?
Well...
Just more videos?
No. I'm not retiring. That's important. I am not retiring anybody. Anybody who wants to hire me can still do it. I just want to be free of the administrative work.
I never got to ask you about perfection in music.
There isn't any.
We've run out of time.
Oh. Next time, I'll be back in October with the Philharmonic.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to that. And you're invited already.
Thanks.
Leonard Slatkin, currently on tour with the Orchestre National de Lyon. It's always a pleasure having you on our show.
So good to see you again.